Why has it been so difficult to get an accurate account of the facts surrounding the situation in Ukraine? How significant was the shooting down of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 to the West's ambitions for Ukraine? In what ways have the investigation of MH17 been compromised? Is there any credibility to reports of human rights abuses by Russians in Crimea and Donbass? How is the recently announced prisoner exchange likely to play out in the context of the broader conflict? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we get some updates on the turmoil gripping Ukraine. Investigative journalist Robert Perry talks about U.S. government and mainstream media obfuscation, particularly of the investigation into the shooting down of MH17. And then Vancouver-based writer and activist Roger Annis shares his analysis of the past, present, and future of the country. On this week's program, breaking through the media fog on Ukraine, MH17, and Cold War 2.0. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 27th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. If Trump becomes U.S. president, there is some possibility, perhaps, that the neoconservatives will cease to dominate U.S. foreign and military policies. Should this turn out to be the case, the Russian nationalists might ease their pressure on Putin to remove the Atlanticist integrationists from the government. If Hillary becomes U.S. president, the neoconservative threat to Russia will escalate. The Atlanticist integrationists will be eliminated from the Russian government and Russia will move to full war standing. As I have previously written, pushing Russia to war means the demise of the US and Europe, and considering the destructive power of nuclear weapons, most likely of all life on Earth. That comes from the article, Will the November U.S. Presidential Election Bring the End of the World? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 25th, originally appearing at Paul Craig Roberts, IPE. The way Germany sees it, the IMF is supposed to lend Greece the money with which to repay the private German banks. Then the IMF is to be repaid by forcing Greece to reduce or abolish old age pensions, reduce public services and employment, and use the revenues saved to repay the IMF. As these amounts will be insufficient, additional austerity measures are imposed that require Greece to sell its national assets, such as public water companies and ports, and protected Greek islands to foreign investors, principally the banks themselves or their major clients. So far, the so-called creditors have only pledged to some form of debt relief, not yet decided, beginning in 2 years. By then, the younger part of the Greek population will have emigrated and will have been replaced by immigrants fleeing Washington's Middle Eastern and African wars, who will have loaded up Greece's unfunded welfare system. That comes from the article, We Have Entered the Looting Stage of Capitalism, once again by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 26th, originally appearing at Paul Craig Roberts, IPE. On the eve of President Obama's April 2016 visit to Saudi Arabia, the U.S. Congress began debating the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act, or JASTA, that would, inter alia, allow the families of victims of the September 11th attacks to sue the Saudi government for damages. Also in April 2016, the New York Times published that a 2002 congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks had found that Saudi officials living in the United States at the time had a hand in the plot. The commission's conclusions, said the paper, were specified in a report that has not been released publicly. On April 28, 2016, the London-based Saudi daily Al Hayat published an exceptionally harsh article on this topic by Saudi legal expert Khatib al-Shamari, who argued that the U.S. itself had planned and carried out 9/11, while placing the blame on a shifting series of others, first al-Qaeda and the Taliban, then Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq, and now Saudi Arabia. He wrote that American threats to reveal documents that supposedly point to Saudi involvement in 9/11 are part of standard U.S. policy of exposing archival documents to use as leverage against various countries, which he calls victory by means of archives. That comes from the article, State Sponsors of Terrorism, U.S. Planned and Carried Out 9/11 Attacks But Blames Other Countries for Them, out by MEMRI, Middle East Media Research Institute, posted May 25th, originally appearing at the website for the Middle East Media Research Institute. Modern monetary theory, which is associated with outstanding economists such as Michael Hudson, makes it clear that countries should finance their infrastructure and any productive investment by creating money, not debt. The use of government debt simply allows private banks to create the money, and the debt has to be serviced with interest paid to the banks, which drains the economy of spending power. Moreover, the debt can end up in hostile hands and be used to destabilize the economy. If Russia is going to allow the West to control its economy, it may as well allow Washington to control its armed forces. Unfortunately for the Russian government and the Russian people, Russia's central bank and neoliberal economists are too naive and gullible to be able to protect Russia from destabilization. That comes from the article, Will Russia Succumb to Washington's Economic Attack? By Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted May 26th, originally appearing at Paul Craig Roberts, IPE. Is it coincidence that Berlin approves and even recommends the hostile takeover of Monsanto by the German agro and pharma giant Bayer? Or is another occult strategic arrangement between Washington and its vassal-in-chief of the EU, Berlin, to push the nefarious Europe-destructive TTIP, that's the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, down the throat of the European population? Under the secretly negotiated TTIP, corporations such as Monsanto would prevail over public opinion. The laws of the corporations, which would bring along their own private court system, would be weighing in above the national courts of sovereign EU members. In fact, any public protests in the streets could be violently oppressed by police and military forces very legally, because a signed and approved TTIP could become the law of the land, hence to be enforced by martial law, if necessary, against the will of the people. That comes from the article, Germany Buys Monsanto and Sells the TTIP to Europe, by Peter Koenig, posted May 25th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Robert Perry is an investigative journalist who broke several of the Iran-Contra stories for Associated Press and Newsweek back in the 1980s, and through the online media outlet ConsortiumNews.com, he's maintained a high standard of reporting on stories which challenge the mainstream narratives. He's focused much of his writing on the situation in Ukraine since the coup of 2014. Robert Perry now joins us from Arlington, Virginia. So thank you very much for being part of our program, Mr. Perry.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, so we're going to discuss a little bit about the situation in Ukraine, and particularly the shoot down of MH17. But I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts, first of all, given your long background in journalism. I know in my very, very, very short time as a broadcast journalist, I've found that there's been few narratives out there that seem to compare with the kind of the wool that seems to be pulling over our eyes around Ukraine, and in terms of the way that dissenting opinions seem to be shut down. I mean, there's a virtually universal you know, like all parties in when the Canadian Parliament, the U.S. Congress, there seems to be an overall consensus of opinion about the fascist dictatorial Putin and you know the situation of U.S. NATO, if anything, kind of coming to the defense against Russian aggression. Is there anything in your experience that compares with it? Because I mean, even with the Iraq War, there seemed to be much more of a dissenting in opinion, at least in my recollection. But what are your thoughts about how distinct the Ukraine narrative has been?
Well, I think it's always the biggest danger that really democracies face when there becomes this groupthink that just dominates how some issue is seen. We did see this with the Iraq War. Yes, there was perhaps a bit more dissent, although there was in terms of the major institutions in Washington. Almost all the major news organizations lined up behind believing that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. You know, the New York Times, the Washington Post, you just go down the line pretty much. There were a couple of dissenters in there, but not much. The same mostly with Congress. There was a great fear about being accused of being a Saddam apologist, so people didn't dare argue that perhaps Saddam Hussein wasn't hiding weapons of mass destruction, because everything was so easy to just pile on and join this groupthink. And there was safety in numbers. As it turned out, even when all those journalists were wrong, and many of those politicians were wrong, there was very, very little accountability. Many of the same people are still running major news organizations today or holding down key jobs. You know, Fred Hyatt, for instance, who's the editorial page editor of the Washington Post, he was in that job back in 2002, 2003, got everything wrong, but he's still there shaping how Washington views the world. So it's a great danger whenever you get into this demonizing of foreign leaders, taking it way beyond what the facts actually present. There's always this tremendous fear that you're going to be called someone's stooge or someone's apologist. So people shut up and they don't examine the facts carefully and objectively. And what we try to do at Consortium News is to just ignore all that pressure and just try to look at the evidence as it's presented. We try to get the various government agencies to release information that can further clarify key incidents. We don't just pile on and go with the flow and take part in the groupthink. And I know we get attacked for that a lot, but that's what journalism is supposed to do. It's not supposed to simply be part of the jump on the bandwagon. You're supposed to, you know, even when someone's unpopular, even when someone's hated, still give that person the same fair shake that you'd give anybody else. The real problem with Ukraine is it's become this sort of ground zero for what they call information warfare. And so it's very hard to know what's real. Mm. And everyone's trying to push to get, you know, their edge. But we've tried to approach this in a way of saying, here's what we see. Here are the facts that back up what we see. And leave it at that. Whether people don't like it, well, that's life of being a journalist sometimes.
I wanted to focus on one aspect in particular of that sort of information war taking place around Ukraine, and that has to do with the firing or the shooting down of Malaysian Airline Flight 17 on July 17th of 2014, and It seems to be a fairly critical narrative, but I wonder if I could get your comments. I mean, I'd like to drill down on a couple of details, but just if you could just express what, you know, how critical, how key is that narrative about it, about Russian-backed rebels, quote-unquote, having been responsible for that tragedy. How critical is that to the overall narrative around Ukraine and U.S. designs there?
Well, there have been a couple of key turning points in the whole Ukraine story where the way the Western media has reported it and what the facts seem to be as best they can be determined at this point don't mesh up. There was, for instance, before the coup back in February of 2014, there was a sniper attack, and immediately the U.S. government and the Washington press corps and the Western press corps in general blamed it on the then embattled President Yanukovych. The evidence, as it's been very, very hard to get to the evidence in some ways, because the government that took over from Yanukovych has not wanted to seriously investigate this. But the evidence seems to point to some element of the right wing having fired on both police and on demonstrators to just touch off what became a very bloody conflict. So the evidence that, as I say, some of this is hard to pin down, but you sort of piece things together and try to look at it objectively, it looks more like that was the case. And that is even the view of some people in the European Union in their foreign policy centers, that this was not something done by Yanukovych. It was done by some people trying to provoke a more severe crisis in Ukraine. Now, so that was an important point. Then we had a similar one. Then after this conflict begins, there's a civil war. There's the Crimeans vote to leave Ukraine because they feel embattled. They're mostly ethnic Russian, and they vote to go back to Russia. Russia accepts that. That's called, in the Western press, that's called a Russian invasion. But then you get to in July, when there's been fighting in the east, which is also the ethnic Russian area of Ukraine. They're resisting this new nationalistic government, Ukrainian government in Kiev. An offensive is underway. The Ukrainian military is making great strides, really, in pushing back the rebels into their territory. And for some reason, there's still commercial airline flights going over eastern Ukraine. They've not been stopped, even though it's an active war zone. And one of them, Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, is shot down, killing 298 people. And the question then becomes, well, who did it? Immediately, frankly, my first impression was that it was probably the rebels, because they had shot down some sort of low-lying planes coming in for landing, military planes. So I think that was my initial thought, like a lot of people. But I consulted with a person who has access to U.S. intelligence analysts, and the person told me, after checking with them, he came back and said, It looks to the U.S. intelligence analysts like it was carried out by some element of the Ukrainian military, possibly an undisciplined group. We know that the Ukrainians had moved their Buk missile systems into the area because they were afraid of a Russian invasion. So I guess that was certainly a possible narrative. But the U.S. government kept pushing this theme that the Russians, the Russian rebels, possibly the Russian government itself, was responsible for this tragedy.
And why is that significant?
Well, because it became the basis for getting the Europeans to get on board with the sanctions that the U.S. government wanted to impose on the Russians. So it basically escalated this new, it sort of pushed us into what we now know is Cold War II, a new Cold War, with all the attendant risks and loss of money and everything else that's going to go into that. So it was always important to figure out exactly what happened, not what was a clever way to make the other guy look bad, but to figure out who was responsible and hold them accountable, whether it was the Russians or the rebels or the Ukrainians, whoever. But that did not seem to be the goal of the U.S. government. It jumped into this and made it into a propaganda weapon. And what was odd is, Secretary of State Kerry goes on the shows, Sunday shows, that following Sunday, the shootdown was on a Thursday. So 3 days later, Kerry's on there trying to pin the blame on the Russian rebels and implicitly the Russian government. And he's saying, we know where this rocket was fired from and so forth. Then a couple of days past that, the U.S. government put out a report which tried to bolster Kerry, but it was quite clear that they had no information that the Russians had provided a Buk missile system to the rebels. There was also one of the analysts who was brought out for some of the mainstream reporters to talk to on background said that maybe the guy who fired it had been a defector from the government and changed sides and then fired the missile. So there was a lot of confusion, clearly. And I kept checking back, and this source would go back and get updates. And as the U.S. government, as the intelligence analysts went back into the details of this, both the satellite intelligence and electronic intelligence, and tried to figure out what happened. What the source was being told by some of these analysts was that it appeared to have been an element of the Ukrainian military, basically broken off a rogue part, working with one of the Ukrainian oligarchs, who had carried out this attack. But that obviously would not have fit with the narrative that the United States wanted people to believe. And so what we saw from that 5 days after the event, when in those first 5 days the U.S. government's trying to pin the blame on the Russians, after that, the U.S. government goes silent. Mm-hmm. And the U.S. government has refused to provide updates. It's refused to give briefings to reporters on what it knows. It's withheld information from the Dutch investigation. The Dutch were assigned to lead the investigation because the plane took off from Amsterdam. So you have this remarkable case of the U.S. government claiming to have known exactly where the missile was fired from 3 days after the attack, and now almost we're getting on to close to 2 years after the event, and the Dutch investigators still don't know where the missile was fired from.
You know, you mentioned the 279-page Dutch report from October of last year. And of course, there's this missing information from the U.S. government. But I was wondering, are there any other significant omissions or were there any other ways in which that investigation was compromised, in your view?
Well, I think there are problems because the Ukrainian government was brought into these investigations under some peculiar proviso that any of the countries involved in the investigation, and there are several, Australia, for instance, is involved, and Malaysia, of course, is involved, and the Dutch and so forth. So there are several governments involved, but each one can prevent any information that they wish from being released publicly. So if the Ukrainian government is a suspect in the case, they're essentially being allowed to be involved in running the investigation and deciding what goes to the public as well. So that's certainly an unusual element to this investigation. But there was another interesting point that was released, an appendix to the Dutch Safety Board report, which was widely ignored at the time. But it was a report from the Dutch Intelligence Service, or at least a report based on the Dutch Intelligence Service's information, in which the Dutch authorities say that there were several of these powerful anti-aircraft missile systems in eastern Ukraine at the time. All the operational ones were under the control of the Ukrainian government as of July 17th, 2014. So what Western intelligence apparently was saying, because the Dutch intelligence is essentially NATO intelligence, is that based on their information, the only weapon systems capable of shooting down MH17 on July 17, 2014 were under the control of the Ukrainian military. Now, they could be wrong on that. I mean, there could be, you know, I suppose they could have been mistaken, but this was something that was released last October. It's been written about some more recently because it was sort of ignored at first. It was, one of the appendices to this long report. But So we have this problem. So while there's plenty of information on the internet and elsewhere, sort of trying to pin the blame on the Russians, the official information, as far as we have it, is either inconclusive or points toward the Ukrainian government being responsible. Now, the point I've tried to make is, why on earth can't the U.S. government just release this material? They claim it's classified, that it's something they can't release because of state secret reasons. But, you know, it's kind of a silly argument because everyone knows the United States has spy satellites, and we know pretty much what those capabilities are, that they're very good cameras on them, and they have infrared capability for things like explosions. They can track missile launches, things of that sort. That's what they're for.
I'm sure they'd be happy to release that information if it served their propaganda purposes.
Well, one can assume that. I mean, because they were releasing information when there was still confusion within the U.S. intelligence community as to what happened. As the U.S. intelligence community got more refined knowledge of what happened, the U.S. government stopped releasing anything. And I think that's pretty extraordinary, because this was a This was a major airline disaster. In most airline disasters, there's tremendous cooperation among all parties to figure out what happened, because there's the desire is to make sure that the public is safe. These things aren't usually turned into propaganda exercises. And I've spent time with the Dutch families, the survivors of people who were killed on that day, and their lives were turned upside down, ruined, destroyed by what happened. And I spent time with them I was at The Hague, where there was a parliamentary inquiry to the Dutch authorities as to why this investigation is being handled in such a bizarre way. And members of the Dutch parliament were asking, why don't you ask for this information relating to the radar and other technical means? Why haven't you asked? This was last February. So this is a year and a half after the event. And the Dutch authorities responsible for the investigation hadn't gotten basic information yet, because they didn't want to ask the Americans for it, because the Americans didn't want to give it to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is all very abnormal. And when you see that kind of behavior, as a journalist, obviously you become suspicious, but you want to stay within the facts. But as the facts, as we have them to this point, at least in terms of what the government, what government authorities have let out, not only are they basically fairly inconclusive, but what evidence there is tends to point toward toward this narrative I was told about, that some element of the Ukrainian military was responsible. Mm-hmm. And you can understand that narrative. That narrative would be that all, assuming that it's just sort of an accident on their part, but you have these fairly undisciplined Ukrainian military units, not particularly well trained, rushing to the front with their weapon systems, expecting possibly a Russian invasion, because at that time the rebels were facing annihilation, and the thinking was maybe the Russians would intervene directly to prevent these ethnic Russian rebels from being crushed. So it made sense for the Ukrainians to move their anti-aircraft missile systems up to the border as close as they could. And there was also some talk that President Putin's plane was returning from South America that day, following a similar route, although it went a bit farther north. So I'm told that U.S. intelligence analysts were looking at the possibility that was a motive, that someone thought this was, since the Malaysian plane had very similar markings to the Russian presidential plane, that they thought they were trying to hit Putin, and they ended up hitting a civilian airliner. I mean, so there are different possibilities. I'm not saying I believe, I don't know, I'm not sure which narrative is correct, but there is reason to understand why the Ukrainians might have either made a mistake or had some undisciplined unit fire on something they thought was one thing and it was turned out to be something else. They were afraid also that the Russians might be attacking. They're just the day before, a Ukrainian warplane that had apparently along the border with Russia had been shot down by an air-to-air missile, presumably fired by the Russians. So the tensions were high. And in those sorts of situations, mistakes are made. That's a possibility, too. But instead of trying to figure out the actual facts, and I think U.S. intelligence has gone a long way to know exactly what happened, we're being left in this fog. And not just me as a journalist or you as a citizen, the families of the victims have been left in a fog. And many of them are being led to believe that they should go and sue the Russians. Some Australians just this week have decided they're going to sue the Russians for this. But the case is extremely murky. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be. It's murky out of choice here, because the U.S. government has made a decision to leave the situation as it is, which I guess they feel is advantageous to their propaganda needs.
Okay. Well, Robert Perry, it's a big topic, and I wish we had a little bit more time to explore it. But I want to thank you for helping to break through that fog and give citizens a much better understanding of these events as they're unraveling. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Robert Perry is an investigative journalist based in Arlington, Virginia. You can find his reports at the website consortiumnews.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Almost 2 years ago, the Ukrainian military began launching an offensive against the Donbass. Tens of thousands have been killed and millions displaced in the wake of merciless bombings and sieges of cities in Donbass and Lugansk. Last Friday, May 21st, Ukrainian President Poroshenko publicly admitted his government's failure to secure those territories by military means. So what are the prospects for peace in this troubled region? And some of the concerns that surround it. Joining us to bring us up to date on events in and around Ukraine is Roger Annis. Roger Annis is a socialist and retired aerospace worker and a longtime champion for peace and social justice causes. He's a contributing editor at the website newcoldwar.org, and his articles have appeared at rabble.ca, counterpunch.org, and of course his own website, rogerannis.com. He joins us now from Vancouver. Hello, Roger Annis, and welcome back.
Hi. It's good to be with you.
I just recently looked at a report from South Front, and in which it was talking about some of the, about 2 weeks ago, it had mentioned an OSCE report on some of the activities there, including Ukrainian armed forces essentially taking over and consolidating territory in the exclusion zone, which is a violation of the Minsk process, as I understand it. So does this point to possibly a summer offensive? Are we looking at here, or how do you make sense of these sorts of events?
Well, they're definitely reporting from the People's Republics in Donetsk and also in Lugansk a buildup of the Ukrainian military forces near to or along the demarcation line that was set by the Minsk II ceasefire process. Difficult to say, because there's certainly also, you know, reports saying that the Ukrainian military has not been and is not in any shape to return to the kind of military offensive that we saw in 2014 and early 2015. They suffered significant military setbacks during that time, and the overall situation in Ukraine has deteriorated on all fronts since then. But it's hard to predict with this regime in power in Kyiv. Overall, it remains an extremely difficult situation for the people in eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Lugansk, because the economic embargo by Ukraine against them continues, and they've effectively, had to join their economy to the economy of Russia and switch to the use of the Russian currency, and they're heavily dependent on Russian financial and other assistance for survival. So there's no sign that Kyiv is going to reverse that. And the military pressure by Ukraine is, it's quite harsh. They are shelling the residential districts in the areas of the People's Republics regularly. Every day this is happening, and some days are worse than others. You mentioned the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Well, it has a monitoring mission there in eastern Ukraine, and they report every day on the violations. Their reports are actually understating the problem. There's much better reporting that happens by the Donetsk International News Agency. But, you know, overall, it's a difficult situation for the people in the east. But there are some positive signs emerging. Number one, pressure on the Ukrainian regime to live up to the Minsk II agreement. And that was an agreement of 13 clauses, virtually every one that the Ukrainian regime has failed to live up to. The key one is that they have to recognize the authenticity of the political leaderships in Donetsk and Lugansk and discuss through a process of political recognition, which would eventually also include elections in the two regions. But Ukraine, that is the regime in Kyiv, has so far refused to do this. So that's the key indicator to watch for. as to whether we'll see any substantial change. Now, there was a discussion just several days ago of what's called the Normandy Four. That's the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France. And the Russian government published a brief report on that discussion. It was a phone conversation. In the report published by the office of the president of Russia, it was, you know, specifically stated that the shellings of the civilian areas of the Donbass region, as it's called, the shellings by Ukraine must cease. And then we've also seen an important prisoner exchange take place in the region. So the combination of that and I think some positive political signals coming from the political leadership of Donetsk and Lugansk gives me some cause for optimism that, perhaps this regime in Ukraine can be pressured and forced to back off from the worst of the violations and abuses that they've been perpetrating.
I think because it's May, this marks the second anniversary, this month marks the second anniversary of the Odessa massacre, in which in that town of the city of Odessa, a number of individuals were chased into the trade union's building and burned alive and killed by other means in rather a despicable action. And I don't know of much attention being paid to it, certainly not by mainstream media or even mainstream trade unions here in Canada or elsewhere. Do you want to comment on maybe what the legacy of those actions and how it may be playing out in the public sphere?
Yeah. Well, there was very good news this year because there was quite a large commemoration event in Odessa itself for the 2-year anniversary of the massacre. 42 people died in the trade union building, either directly from the arson attack, or they were literally beaten to death as some of those who tried to escape from the building, and then others died the same day in the clashes with the right wing gangs that had come to Odessa to provoke a confrontation. So several thousands of people rallied this year to commemorate the event. And there were also, importantly, there were international observers who were there present, both in some cases to express solidarity, in other cases to make sure that a commemoration event could take place safely without violence. The extreme right in the city and in the country tried to disrupt and prevent the commemoration from happening. And the police were, the Ukrainian police, in the city and region, we're also trying to dissuade people from participating and to prevent the event from happening, but that wasn't successful. So that's a pretty good sign. And also, there's been a very interesting development coming out of the Donetsk Republic now, which is that the leadership of the Donetsk People's Republic, and specifically the First Minister Alexander Zakharchenko, have undertaken a series of kind of open line conversations with people in Ukraine using technology similar to Skype. They can't use television because Ukraine has cut off the television signals coming from Russian-speaking eastern Ukraine into Ukraine proper, but they can use this internet technology. So we've now had three of these, you could call them sort of town hall meetings between the leadership of the Donetsk Republic and interested people in Ukraine who want to participate. And so this is a very good sign, I think, that, despite all the blockages created by Ukraine, that such dialogue could be initiated and deepened. Your listeners could go to our website, New Cold War, and read a summary of the latest, a third such exchange that took place between Zakharchenko and the people of the Kherson region. So I'm very encouraged by it because I think that it's really important for the political leaders in Donetsk and Lugansk to kind of convey their message to the Ukrainian people that really they have a common struggle to build a different society, one in which that's not dominated by the wealthy economic elite of Ukraine that repudiates this ultra-nationalist, Russia-hating ideology of the right wing of Ukraine, and that joins together in building a common republic. And, they're certainly thinking along these lines in Donetsk and Lugansk. And, of course, they have many people in Ukraine itself who want to join with that message. So this is a very, I think, positive piece of news that's come out recently.
On the first anniversary of the tragedy, a number of rallies, vigils, and demonstrations were staged in centers around the world. In Winnipeg, Canada, I was present at one such demonstration near the new Canadian Museum for Human Rights. A handful of individuals stood off to the side and expressed disapproval of the protests and what they considered pro-Putin propaganda. I took the opportunity to record their thoughts.
The referendum was monitored by Europeans. What kind of Europeans? The neo-Nazi far-right parties in Austria, in Denmark, in France, and in Britain. The far right.
A Russian human rights group did an investigation of the referendum, and their report was that the figures were wildly inflated, that this was not a free, fair, anything like that, that this was a farce.
And another thing, 15% of the population was neither Russian or Ukrainian. It was Tartar. And as of now, all the Tartar language radio stations, TV stations, and newspapers have been shut down.
There was a demonstration, not this year, but on the anniversary of the Odessa massacre, and it was a small group of people, mostly of ethnic Russian Ukrainian descent. But there was a couple of people there who you could say were heckling somewhat and held a very different view. And when I went to talk to them, they mentioned things about, particularly about Crimea. And one of them cited this supposedly authoritative report from March of 2015 about human rights abuses in Russian-occupied Crimea. It was written or authored by Andriy Klimenko, who is the chief editor of Black Sea News and the chairman of the supervisory board of Maidan of Foreign Affairs. And incidentally, Black Sea News was one of the media outlets that was on record as not supporting the annexation of Crimea. So I don't know what that might say about the objectivity of this report. But anyway, it was listing a number of discriminatory policies toward the ethnic Tatar minority and the intimidation of independent voices. And, it said that the referendum was conducted under occupation conditions with all these Russian soldiers with guns and all that. And, So I was wondering, since you've been to Crimea, if I'm not mistaken, and I was wondering what your thoughts were about the human rights situation in Crimea, if there's much foundation there for these concerns.
Yeah, well, this is a familiar theme that they, the supporters of the Kiev regime and the supporters of the coup in February 2014 keep trying to sound, because they're very angry at the outcome of it. Events in Crimea. As I, described, the people of Crimea decided through the referendum in March of 2014 to put an end to the accident of history that had taken them out of Russia or the Russian Federation and placed them in the Ukrainian Federation back in 1954. There's several things to remember about the original referendum in 2014. Crimea was facing the same kind of threat of civil war, which we saw unfold in eastern Ukraine. And so the vote that was held in Crimea was a vote saying, we're not going to allow a civil war to come to our territory. And the only assurance that we can have that this won't take place is to secede from Ukraine and rejoin the Russian Federation. And then any attack by Ukraine would be, an attack of one country on another. So this is, this was the combination of the accident of history where they had been Crimea had been placed in Ukraine without a consultation originally, with this imminent threat that they faced. The other thing about the referendum is that Crimea was because of its unique history and place in Ukraine, was the only part of Ukraine that had an autonomous regional and elected assembly. Ukraine is a highly centralized country. It doesn't have provinces with provincial governments. It doesn't have provincial governments similar to what we have in Canada or similar to state governments in the U.S. All the power is in Kiev, but Crimea was the exception because of its unique place in history. And so it was that elected institution of the Crimean people which conducted the referendum in March of 2014. And sure, it was a somewhat of a rushed referendum because they were staring down, a civil war that was being threatened upon them. There's certainly no question that the vast majority of people in Crimea voted in favor of secession, and the polls that had been conducted, including in some cases by Western sources, following the secession decision, as much as a year after the secession decision, the polls showed the Crimean people, confirming that their original decision, that they were satisfied with the outcome, although not necessarily satisfied with, whatever the government is doing then or now in Crimea. That's a different question. Crimea is on the road to economic rehabilitation, to get out of the stagnation that they were facing in Ukraine. And as far as the human rights situation, well, let's remember two things. Firstly, one of the first acts of the new government of Crimea, now seceded from Ukraine and rejoining the Russian Federation, was to make legal in law, with all of the associated rights, education, healthcare, and so on, of three languages, Russian, Tatar, and Ukrainian. Prior to the secession vote, there was only one official language in Crimea, which was Ukrainian. And the people who suffered most from that situation were the Tatar people, who as a result of not having their language in any kind of legal status, had to fight for every square inch of public education in their own language, of other government services in their own language, and so on. Now, the reports that have been issued, for example, by the Atlantic Council, which is a stridently right-wing and pro-Ukraine, pro-coup d'etat in Ukraine institution, speak of human rights violations. We can't sort of confirm or deny a specific individual case that they would raise, as in any country, any citizen, you or I tomorrow, could be up against an abusive policeman, who violates our rights, or could be up against an institution that's insensitive to some issue that's concern to us. But as a general rule, the notion of kind of systematic violations of human rights taking place in Crimea, and specifically taking place against the Tatar people, is simply bogus. These reports just gather scattered information, which is, are not kind of documented by more credible human rights organizations. And I don't see the Atlantic Councils of the world going to Crimea itself with, shall we say, neutral observer missions to investigate the situation and then report. They concoct these reports, and they even get documentary films made. Whereas I can say for sure that our, those with whom we're working and publishing our website and, all of the news reports that we watch for very closely, paint a very different story, that is of for sure none of the kind of systematic violations of human rights that the supporters of right-wing Ukraine want to convince us are taking place in Crimea.
One of the concerns was the monitoring, and like one of the people suggested that that somehow these groups, the monitoring bodies, were quote unquote right wing neo Nazi elements from France and Denmark and so on. I mean, what can you say about the authority and the credibility of those election observers who witnessed the referendum and concluded that this was a fair referendum?
Well, I don't know the specific accounts. I mean, we read the news reports that were published, and if you read, you don't even have to read between the lines. If you go back and read what the New York Times, the Guardian, some of the major Western media were writing, they all said that this referendum reflected a clear majority sentiment of the Crimean people. You'd have to look closely and find, but I've seen it there often enough. What they say, what they try to argue, is what the kind of overall tenor of the presence of Russia and so on, sort of you could say, almost kind of intimidated people into voting the way that they did. And that just doesn't hold up. I don't think there were that many observers there at the time of the March 2014 referendum. It's too bad that, instead of succumbing to, what I would say are basically propaganda reports on the situation in Crimea, that, you know, people with some authenticity and credibility, didn't go to Crimea and investigate for themselves. And, you know, what they will see in Crimea today is a rather dynamic situation of, very significant investment coming into the region by Russia to make up for all the years of stagnation that Crimea suffered. And this investment is bringing, Crimea's first autonomous energy supply. So they can't be faced with electricity cutoff, which Ukraine imposed on them at the end of last year. They're building a bridge, the first direct bridge connection from Russia to Crimea. Now let's recall, as of, again, late last year, all road transport, commercial road transport between Ukraine and Crimea was cut off by Ukraine. People supporting Ukraine are crying human rights violations, but turning a blind eye to road, commercial road transport, including food, being embargoed, cut off by Ukraine, to where the electricity supply, all of which came from Ukraine, most of which came from Ukraine before, literally the electricity cables supplying Crimea were blown up by the extreme right wing of Ukraine, and the Ukrainian government did nothing. In fact, they said they ratified what was done. So, this is a good and dynamic situation. Certainly not without its problems. And if you want to delve into the Russian language Crimean press, you'll find, quite lively debates of people, proposing different courses and critical of what the government is doing. So, I don't give any credibility at all to this attempt to portray Crimea as being some kind of a place of, considerable and ongoing human rights violations. On the contrary, this is a place that's moving forward right now. Unlike Ukraine, which is in complete economic stagnation and going backwards.
Okay. Now, I wanted to bring up just in events from earlier this week in which there was a prisoner swap, prisoner exchange involving the convicted Ukrainian paramilitary Nadia Savchenko in exchange for the Russian citizens.
This is quite important. Savchenko became was elevated into the status of a folk hero by the authorities in Ukraine. She was a member of the Ukrainian armed forces who took a leave of absence in order to join one of the neo-Nazi paramilitary battalions fighting in eastern Ukraine in May of 2014, and she did that because in the early stages of the civil war in Ukraine, the regular Ukrainian army proved to be an unreliable instrument for the extreme right of Ukraine, because these ordinary soldiers simply refused orders to fire on their fellow citizens in the east of Ukraine. And that's really one of the origins of the rise of these extreme right paramilitary battalions. And so people like Nadia Savchenko, joined these battalions because they were angry at the Ukrainian army for not acting like them, accepting this offensive against civilians in the east of the country. And then she was working in a unit which killed through shelling several Russian journalists, and that was the criminal charge for which she was found guilty in a Russian court several months ago now. So her case became a cause célèbre. Now the Minsk ceasefire agreement has a clause which says there should be an exchange of all prisoners on both sides. Ukraine has been stalling on that prisoner exchange, and there have been some exchanges, but it's been dribs and drabs. The majority of people, the political prisoners that Ukraine is holding, have not been released. They are not willing even to be able to get an exchange from their vantage point, and not willing to do. On the surface, this exchange, Savchenko was exchanged for two Russians who were accused not of any violent crime in Ukraine, but they were accused of being in Ukraine. They were in Odessa, basically there to express solidarity with the movement in Odessa. And so they were accused of various sort of anti-terrorist clauses. So two Russian citizens, you know, convicted in a court in Ukraine, exchanged for Nadia Savchenko. I like to think there's a lot more to this story that we'll find out in the coming days and weeks, because given the status of Savchenko in Ukraine, it seems not a lot gotten in exchange for her by the Russian government, particularly in a situation where Ukraine is actually in violation of the Minsk agreement by not conducting substantive prisoner exchanges. So I think we might get more good news in the days or weeks ahead on the prisoner exchange front, that there's possibly an element of this agreement which goes deeper than just the three individuals involved. I like to think also that this might take a little bit of the wind out of the sails of the Kiev regime's very bellicose and militaristic approach, that here you have this woman who's been elevated into heroine status in Ukraine, released by after being convicted of a very serious crime of complicity in the murder of two Russian journalists, and yet the Russian government agrees to a prisoner exchange. I like to think this will take the wind out of the sails of those who present Russia as this total monster who's trying to ruin Ukraine and everything else. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed and hope that we hear some more good news in the days or few weeks ahead, where we'll see many more exchanges and more difficult for Ukraine more difficult for the Ukraine to buy the silence of Western media as it keeps perpetrating these daily shellings against the people of Eastern Ukraine.
Okay. I think that we've got to wrap it up right about now, Roger. But if there's any maybe an upcoming article or anything like that that you'd like to direct people to.
I could just encourage readers to follow what we're doing on the website. We're putting a lot of daily news and information on the website about the situation in Ukraine. And we're also providing a lot of information about the situation in Turkey and also in Syria, where Russia's foreign policy, I think, has been playing quite a positive role in trying to put an end to the regime change chaos in the Middle East that was seeking to overthrow the Syrian government. We have very bad political developments in Turkey, with this the government there becoming more and more right-wing and turning more and more to violence against the Kurdish people. So there again, I like to think that the positive outcomes of Russian policy are going to be very beneficial to Ukraine, that it's very hard for Ukraine to sell to the world and sell to Western media the idea of an aggressive unruly and untrustworthy Russian government, in a situation where it seems pretty clear to the world that Russia is actually doing a lot to try and ratchet down this this regime change policy in the Middle East out of control. So that's another thing I think to watch for in the coming days and weeks.
Roger Annis, thank you very much.
You're welcome. It's been good talking to you.
Vancouver-based Roger Annis is a longtime champion for peace and social justice causes and a prolific writer. He's a contributing editor to the website newcoldwar.org, and his articles have appeared at rabble.ca, counterpunch.org, and, of course, his website, rogerannis.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.